I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is new urgency in the voices of those calling for aid in Darfur, Sudan. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is warning African leaders of a humanitarian catastrophe. But progress is slow. Those African leaders have agreed to send in soldiers, but only enough to protect the people trying to monitor a ceasefire that seems to be violated on a daily basis as it is. The leaders are still pushing for diplomatic cooperation from the government of Sudan. However, it is the government-armed militia who continue to terrorize the citizens of West Sudan. Reports indicate that people are still being forced into the wilderness. It's estimated that now 1 million people have fled their homes in fear of attacks by those government-backed militia. USAID is warning that 350,000 people are now at risk of starvation. We have a number of people joining us this hour to talk about what they've seen. We'd like to hear from you as well. Does it or should it matter if Darfur is termed a genocide? Technically, such a label could bring more intervention and more sanctions against the Sudanese government. But would it really make a difference? Or are these the sorts of humanitarian crises that are always going to come down to a more simple calculus of those who have more helping those with less? We start today's program with Samantha Power. She's the author of a book called A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. She's currently in Chad. I talked to her earlier today and asked her about the refugee camps that she's been visiting there, where scores of people have fled to escape the violence in Darfur.
Well, I'm in the town of Bahai at the Chad-Sudan border, and this is a town where about 30,000 refugees are gathered. So there's a scramble for resources, for water and for firewood. The kinsmen of the people who've crossed in initially welcomed the refugees, but now the firewood is running out. It's the very end of the dry season. There's an awful lot of tension between the local people and the refugees who are coming in from Darfur, Sudan. But it has to be said that the people who've made it into Chad are the lucky ones. Literally hundreds of thousands of people are living in the mountains, trying to fend for themselves without seeds, without animals or livestock, because the Janjaweed, the militias, of course, have taken the livestock. So the people I'm meeting, as desperate as they are and as much as they've lost all their goats, all their sheep, all their camels, all their cows. I mean, they're devastated. These are all farming people and herding people. They are lucky, and they're mainly worried about the people that they know who are in towns further away who just simply can't make it to the border because, of course, the Janjaweed have taken their animals, and thus those people have no way of traveling the length of Darfur to make it inside.
So does that mean then, Samantha, that there are not as many people making it into these camps in Chad anymore?
Yes, the it is a trickle now, only a trickle, at least up here in Bahai and Kariari. I believe since we have been here over the course of the last 5 or 6 days, they've had about 30 or 40 arrivals, which is to be contrasted with, 1,000 a week and sometimes 300 in a day, just 3 and 4 weeks ago. So you're really seeing, I think, people trying to make do within Sudan, within Darfur, and again, I can't imagine that's easy because there are internally displaced persons camps that aid organizations are reaching when the Sudanese government allows them, but there's a whole number of people who are displaced persons who are just on their own, on the loose, that no one can account for.
Thanks a lot. Stay safe.
Thank you for having me.
That's Samantha Power, the author and human rights activist, talking to us earlier this morning from Chad. Joining me now from the Desmet studios in Amsterdam is Kenny Gluck. Kenny is the operational director for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. He returned from the Sudan border 3 weeks ago, where he was negotiating with government officials to try and get relief workers into the area. Hello, Kenny.
Good morning.
It's good of you to join us. I understand that just that work of negotiating with government officials is pretty difficult.
No, absolutely. This has been a long struggle to convince the government of Sudan to allow aid in, given the scale of the crisis and given how long it's been going on. And many of these people have been displaced for 9 months. We've been extremely frustrated because the aid for many, many months just wasn't allowed in. We had many of our doctors, nurses, medical personnel who were waiting months and months for visas. We had difficulty getting vehicles, and we had difficulty getting in just the food and medicines which we needed to respond to this.
Can you bring us into
going on literally for months?
Bring us into one of those conversations, Kenny. What could a Sudanese government official say to you across a table to discourage just the simple moving of food or medicine into the people who need it?
No, it was never saying we will not allow the aid in. It's always finding another customs rule which needed was supposedly broken, another form which needed to be filled out, another official which needed to be met. And this is the kind of work which is unacceptable. When you have a crisis of this magnitude with as many as a million people displaced, but also levels of mortality which are way above what should be acceptable in any crisis, you need to be able to move in aid quickly. And the government not only didn't facilitate this, they obstructed it for many, many months.
You're one of the more experienced operational directors for MSF. You've done this kind of work in Chechnya, in Bosnia, in Congo. I'm wondering if you can describe what you saw in Sudan that distinguishes this, that sticks in your mind from the time that you spent there.
What sticks in the mind is not only the scale of the crisis, but in the last few years we have had few crises of this magnitude in which the international community has failed so dramatically to provide assistance to these people. So you had people who were driven out of their villages, burned out of their villages, losing everything, like Samantha Power mentioned, losing their livestock, losing their lands, losing their grain stores, often losing many family members. And it was often many, many months, 6, 7, 8, 9 months before aid reached them. Darfur is already a place which lives very close to the margins of survival. And when people lose their access to food, when they lose their livelihoods, they tend to get into malnutrition very quickly. And this is one case in which aid just didn't reach them. And the government of Sudan has the primary responsibility for obstructing the aid. I also think we have to ask the UN agencies, the NGOs, why they were so slow in arriving to this. I think that's one of the things that sticks out in this conflict. The other, we have to say, and it's very painful, in most crises that we're looking at, certainly in Congo, most of the death was due to the secondary effects of the crisis. So you have people who are driven into malnutrition with a health care system which is destroyed. So they die from malnutrition. They die from disease because there's no means to feed them. There's no means to care for them. One of the shocking things which comes out of MSF's surveys in the area is the extremely high number of people who are dying from the direct results of violence. In some of the areas where we did a survey, for example, 75% of the deaths among women in a three-month period in one of the largest camps in Sudan, they died of direct violence. This is gunshot wounds, these are explosives, and this is machete wounds. These are the kind of kind of targeted violence against civilians, which really sticks out in this conflict.
And when you're there trying to get an overall sense of the picture, Kenny, do you have the time at all to speak to people who've been forced from their villages, people who have endured these attacks both from the air and from the ground? Were there personal stories that people told you?
Oh, absolutely. You can't help but take the time to listen to people when they're coming into our clinics, when they're coming into our feeding centers. And the stories are both tragic and very consistent. You hear them in time and time again, and they reflect a desperation. These twin failings that have happened, the inability to protect people from violence, but also the lack of assistance, has forced families into horrible choices that they tell you about, and it's certainly something which burdens our teams. A typical one is the situation of families who are starving. They're not getting enough food to eat, and they feel that the only way that you can get access to some food is by going out into the outside of the towns in search of firewood to trade for food. And the women tell you, but going out for firewood in order to feed yourself and your children means the risk of systematic rape. And often this is extremely violent over long periods of time. And for the men, it means a real risk of execution. And some people were so terrified by this, but also so desperate, they end up sending out little children in the middle of the night on the hope that children will be a little bit less subject to the targeted violence. This is the kind of horrible choices that the lack of assistance and the lack of protection forces people into, and people are very forthright in telling you about it and complaining about it.
How is it that the same people who scare these people out of their villages, who attack them and rape them and torture them, can then live so close to the camps to inflict this kind of terrorism from outside, where people can't even go out to get a stick of firewood. I kind of had it in my mind, Kenny, that the militia were working only in the area where they're moving the people out, but it sounds like they're following them.
Well, we're in the areas that we're working. Sometimes the same militias which have conducted this campaign of terror against the villages, they're the ones who are, in the government's words, providing security for these camps. So the people who were burned out of their villages by these militias are now often being guarded by them. And that's one of the reasons why this campaign of terror really hasn't ended. People are living in the presence of the same people who committed these atrocities, and these atrocities still happen. Even in the camps where people have fled to for safety, they're still subjected to enormous levels of rape, and they're still subjected to the some of the same torture and some of the same executions that we were seeing in the past. There's come an insidious practice of taxing people. So people who try to get out of a town, again, in search of firewood to trade for food, they're often taxed for the privilege of getting out of that camp, in addition to putting themselves at risk of violence.
When people listen to the description of what you've seen there, there are a number of different ways ways I imagine our listeners thinking about it as well, Kenny, and that is, you know, are countries like the United States being led down the garden path by Sudanese officials who are saying, oh, yeah, we'll get on top of that, just give us some time? Are the NGOs and the UN, are they well enough focused on it now? Are people, just ordinary citizens of countries like America, paying enough attention?
The UN and the NGO response is enormously late. Like I was saying, that a lot of the displaced people, they're only receiving aid 8-9 months after they were forced to flee from their villages. And I think in a more just world, they would have the ability to ask why. It's we're happy that Colin Powell and his visit and Kofi Annan and his visit are finally bringing a high level of attention to this. But the response so far can't really give us much cause for optimism. The only thing that they've been promised is African Union monitors. This is a territory the size of France, and so far there are 20-odd monitors on the ground. The monitors told Kofi Annan last week that the ceasefire was being observed. The same day, we had helicopters flying over our feeding centers, which is terrifying enough for people who have been bombed out of their villages, but the helicopters went on to bomb nearby villages. This was just happening at the same day that Kofi Annan was being told by the monitors that the ceasefire is being observed.
Let me stop you if I can there for half a second, Kenny, because we're coming up to a break. I just want to give word to our listeners here. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest for the balance of the hour and more to come from Kenny Gluck, Operational Director for Doctors Without Borders, there to answer questions about what's going on in Western Sudan, where so many people have been chased from their homes, and also a different voice when we come back after the break, but your chance to find out from people who've been there firsthand. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour about the conditions for people in Western Sudan and living in the refugee camps in Chad. We have with us Kenny Gluck, Operational Director for Doctors Without Borders, just back 3 weeks ago from the Sudan border. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're bringing Jerry Fowler onto the program now. He's Staff Director of the Committee on Conscience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. He returned last month from visiting the camps in Chad, where he was talking with the refugees there. He's joining us from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Jerry, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning, Dick.
Tell me what it was that took you to Chad. Was it your role as a representative with the Holocaust Museum?
It was indeed. The Holocaust Museum was concerned about the threat of genocide in Darfur, and so I was sent to gather firsthand testimonies to talk to refugees and hear their stories and try to get a closer look as to exactly what was happening inside Sudan.
I'm hearing those words never again somewhere in the back of my mind. I'm sure they were very much in the forefront of your consciousness.
Well, one thing that I've been saying is, the historical practice has been to wait until something like this is over and say never again. And what I'd like people to start saying now is not this time, not this time in Darfur.
Did you find the people there willing or even eager to tell their stories to you?
Very much so. In fact, that was one of the most poignant aspects of it, was the eagerness of people to tell their stories and how much it appeared to mean to them that someone was listening. And it reminded me very much of what I've heard from many Holocaust survivors about how abandoned the Holocaust survivors felt 60 years ago during the Holocaust, thinking that nobody cared about what was happening to them at the time. And for the refugees in Chad, they very much want their stories told and really want to do, they were very eager to talk about what had happened to them.
Is there one that you want to share with us, one that sticks in your mind, one person's story?
Well, there were many. One in particular, though, I think, actually was a woman that I talked to in Bahai, where Samantha Power is now. And this woman had just crossed over the border, which is just a few hundred meters away, 2 days earlier. And she was literally living underneath a tree with her few possessions strewn around her. She had a few blankets and some water jugs and some bowls. And she had two bullet wounds in her right leg. And she had been shot when she and a 17-year-old girl went to a well on the Sudanese side to get water for themselves and for other refugees who were fleeing. And there was a Sudanese soldier guarding the well, obviously apparently guarding it so that the refugees would not be able to get water. And the soldier grabbed the 17-year-old girl, and when the woman tried to pull the girl away, the soldier shot her and took the girl away. And
does anybody know what happened to the girl?
The girl's father found her later in a ravine with both of her legs broken.
Kenny Gluck, the difference in the stories from two sides of the border, I don't want to dwell on this, but I think it's important to understand when Jerry's talking about people who've made it into Chad, Samantha was saying they're the lucky ones, that the people who are still stuck in Sudan have it even worse. Is that your view of it as well?
No, we have teams on the Chad side of the border as well, and although the people and the refugees who have made it to Chad are still facing inadequate water and inadequate food, so we're very worried about their nutritional status and their health status, but at least they're not as exposed to the violence as people who've remained in Darfur. In some of the villages we were working in, we had. One case I remember was two young girls. I think one of them was 10 and one of them was 12. Their families were too scared. They both had gunshot wounds, but the families were too scared to let us take them to a hospital. They said that they would be kidnapped along the way, or they would be killed. So we were in at least in Chad, people are not so terrified that they can't make it to a clinic. They can't make it to a hospital. In Darfur, the nature of the terror is that people, even wounded people, even people we've told that they need to get to a hospital or they'll die. We will take them to a hospital or they'll die, and they still say no. They're scared to go that road. Mm. So I think that's the difference between Chad and Darfur at this point. Is in Chad, people are not getting the food, they're not getting the water they need, and that's a big problem. But on top of that, in Darfur, they're still living in a condition of terror where they're scared to go out, they're scared to fend for themselves, and that's something that needs to be addressed.
Jerry Fowler, for many of these people, they have grown up in a country that has been at war all their lives, either the civil war in Sudan between the north and the south, or the recent fighting that's taken place between the Arab Sudanese, the Black Sudanese. I mean, I know that's a part of the conflict that we're describing here. who do they trust? Do you find, as Kenny describes, that there are people who may not want to talk to you or may not want to accept the aid that might be offered because government to them has always represented more a threat than assistance?
Well, the sense that I got from talking to people was not so much that they were unwilling to trust people who were giving aid, but they were very fearful of the Sudanese government and, of course, of these Janjaweed militias. And as Kenny says, the people in Chad were somewhat beyond the reach of the government. And so I didn't find them fearful of accepting aid, especially from Doctors Without Borders, whose operations I saw while I was in Chad, and just would express my great admiration for the work that they're doing there. But the fear definitely and the distrust was almost palpable whenever they would talk about the Sudanese government or the militias. And they see the two as being hand in hand. They very much believe that the militias are supported by the government and are doing the government's bidding. And, of course, there's a lot of other evidence that suggests they're right about that.
We have a number of people who'd like to speak to both of you, and I'm going to start with Fred, who's joining us on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Fred, thanks for calling.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for taking my call. I was listening on my car radio, and I listened for several minutes, and I did not hear what is the driving force, what's the reason, what's the motivation for this militia and or the Sudanese government for driving these people out of their villages and raping and killing. What group is it? What's their objective? I didn't hear that. I think I know the answer, but I haven't heard it.
No, I'm glad you asked the question. I'm going to ask Kenny Gluck to help us with this. Kenny, we can go back to a time about a year and a half ago when there was a small rebellion in Western Sudan. And is that the excuse that the government is using for arming the militia and sending them out to the villages?
I don't know what the excuse is that the government is using. I think that there does the I can't comment on the objectives. I don't know because we're mostly dealing in clinics and feeding centers. But what people tell us is whatever the objective was, it was clearly intentional strategy to get them out of their villages. So the people were herded out, the villages were burned, the grain storage were destroyed, oftentimes wells were destroyed. So it was clearly a systematic and deliberate attempt to drive them out of their villages. But I think even the people we were talking with, they didn't know. Often they talked about plans to steal their lands, plans to steal their livestock. But they themselves were wondering what's the source of this violence.
Is it wrong to see it in ways that I've seen it written about, and that is largely Arab militia attacking black African Sudanese?
Lots of the people in our clinics and in our feeding centers talk about how this is a strategy of the Arabs, but I don't think I don't think the lines are so clearly drawn.
And Jerry, what were the stories that you were hearing? Were people talking of ethnic cleansing in Chad?
Yes, people believed that they were being targeted because of their group identity. Part of it is perceptions of racial differences, and part of it is what you might call ethnic differences, difference in lifestyle, difference in culture, difference in language. I think it is true, as Kenny suggested, that in the longer term, a lot of these groups are fluid and there's movement among them. But in the very near term, there's been kind of, as far as I understand, a rigidification of the group identity. And in particular, the government, in response to this rebellion that began in the early part of last year, basically has identified the civilian population of certain groups as being the enemy and has launched these attacks against those civilians.
Jerry Fowler is staff director of the Committee on Conscience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. He is just back from a visit in to the refugee camps in Chad. Kenny Gluck is also with us. He's operational director for Doctors Without Borders, recently back from the Sudan side of that same border just 3 weeks ago where he was working there. And Connection listeners, your chance to speak to them about their experiences, what they saw, their assessment of just how difficult, how dire the situation is becoming for the hundreds of thousands there. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Chapel Hill, North Carolina is next, and John's on the line. John, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yes, my question is, where are we going from here? RTP, that means Research Triangle Park down here in North Carolina, our Silicon Valley, but in the words of Kofi Annan in 2020 Hindsight on Rwanda, RTP is responsibility to protect. And I really hope that the rest of the program will talk about the prospects of getting an adequate force in there to stop the raping, killing, robbing jailers of these people who have been ethnic cleansed. I don't really care whether you call it genocide. It certainly is a bad situation. And we've got, as of last Tuesday, 3 weeks to do something before the rains come, and then the jailers won't make that much difference because the place will be completely inaccessible and the disease will take over. So I'll take the rest off the air.
And thank you for your call, John. I'll point out that 10 years ago, the man who is now in charge of the United Nations was head of the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations. Kofi Annan was the sort of principal person charged with driving the UN response to the genocide in Rwanda. So when John speaks, Jerry, about what are the lessons of Rwanda in acting quickly and responsibly to this, it's a pretty apt comparison, I suppose.
Well, I think there are definitely parallels, and to echo what Kenny said earlier, we're already very, very late in responding to this, the crisis. And as John says, one of the things that is going to make this even worse, and is probably making it worse as we speak, are seasonal rains that move up from the south and make accessibility to the displaced persons that much more difficult. I do think that, in contrast to Rwanda, we see the Secretary of State going to the region, the United States government saying that they see indicators of genocide, and we see Kofi Annan going to the region. And now I think all eyes are on Kofi Annan and Colin Powell and the Security Council in New York to see some vigorous and unrelenting action to bring this situation under control.
Are you persuaded or hopeful that that might happen as a result of those visits, Jerry?
I remain to be persuaded. I'm hopeful because I don't know that we have any option, but I think it's clear the magnitude of the disaster has not been yet met by the magnitude of the response. And I know that the United States is circulating a resolution in the Security Council, and time is fleeting. And the United Nations officials, including the head of humanitarian affairs, has been saying this for quite some time now. It's a race against time.
Kenny Gluck, you're probably got a better sense of just what the effect of the rains could be or would be on either the lives of the people there or the effort to try and get food and medicine in. How do you see it?
No, the rains are a very scary issue for us. They've already started. The rainy season has already started in many of the areas we're working. What scares us is that the malnutrition is not going to be combated. If the food can't get in because in the rainy season it becomes extremely difficult to travel in this region, if the agencies which are responsible for food distribution can't get the general food rations in, we're going to see a much larger slide into malnutrition, and a lot of people are going to die from that. MSF does what we call therapeutic and supplementary feeding, which is feeding the most severely malnourished. But unless somebody is delivering full rations to these people, we're going to see a lot more deaths due to disease and malnutrition. And even before the rainy season, it wasn't happening. Looking at the period from January to April in Mornay, which is probably the largest concentration of displaced people, about 80,000 people. People were only getting 1,000 kilocalories a day. And that
is
a starvation ration. That is less than half of what the body needs to sustain itself.
What is that, like a biscuit? I'm not sure what the people
that's,
are getting.
That's a few hundred grams of sorghum in this case. It's not enough to sustain the body, so it is a slide into slow starvation, and that was an area which the UN was distributing in. Now with the rainy season, if food distribution becomes more difficult, populations like the groups in Mornay, they're not going to be able to survive through the rainy season. This is what we're scared about, and this is why we need the UN in particular to really scale up the aid effort, particularly to get the food in. The other issue is in many of these camps, people have crowded together, and these are not well-planned or serviced camps. This is really just a spontaneous camp where people have crowded into a village for safety. There aren't sufficient latrines, and when you get the rainy season coming in, we're very scared of real outbreaks of waterborne diseases, and particularly cholera, and that can have a devastating effect on a camp.
Jerry Fowler, what were the people eating in the camps that you visited?
Well, in the camps in Chad, people were eating food that was distributed by the United Nations, although at the time that I was there, in several of the camps I was in, they were having a problem even there where there was no government obstruction getting sufficient supplies. But basically the distribution was very basic. It consisted of some grain, usually sorghum, as Kenny said, in two of the camps, flour, some beans, what you might call field peas, and all the field peas that I saw, and I didn't do a comprehensive survey, But they were not very high quality. They had been eaten by bugs. They had holes in them. And then a little bit of oil. And that basically constitutes the diet for these refugees.
All right, Connection listeners, the point has been made that the world community, the NGOs, the UN, everybody comes very late to the situation in Western Sudan. We have two people who are recently returned from those areas where refugees and displaced people are living. The rainy season is, as you just heard, upon them. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, a chance for you to join our conversation about Darfur in Western Sudan. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio this hour, talking about the violence and the starvation in being endured by people in Western Sudan, also in the refugee camps in Chad. Kenny Gluck is with us. He's operational director for Médecins Sans Frontières, and Jerry Fowler, staff director of the Committee on Conscious at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And just a note for those of you with access to our website, we are at theconnection.org, and we have on our website a gallery of very powerful images that Jerry has provided, and also a link to the Holocaust Memorial Museum, because they have issued a genocide warning and, in fact, have done quite an elaborate takeout looking at just exactly what's going on for the people there. You can find them by going to our website and clicking on the link. Our number to join this conversation is 1-800-423-TALK to Potsdam, New York. And Augustine is on the line. Augustine, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yes, I'm originally from Sudan. And about 10 years ago, we wrote articles concerning the slavery in Sudan as a serious human rights issue, and I would like to your listeners and your panelists to comment on the fact that the issue of slavery in Sudan has really never been tackled by the international community head on.
And Augustine, can I interrupt you for a second? Is the slavery that you describe in some way linked to the way that the people are fighting each other in that country today?
Well, the slavery that I describe is linked to the fact that there has, for a very long time, always been a systematic, attempt by the people that claim, Arab, Muslim, background, that has been systematically enslaving African, regardless of their religious affiliation. And that shows through in all these gruesome forms of violence. That there's a common denominator that the world community really has not fully addressed.
I'm glad you called, Augustine. I thank you for that. I want to, if I can, turn it to Jerry Fowler. We touched earlier on the North-South Civil War that has been so much a part of the history of Sudan for the past decades, Arab-African violence. When Augustine talks about the history of slavery taking place within the borders of that country, I mean, part where I'm trying to go with this, I guess, Jerry, is that what we're talking about, this latest violence, the people who have been shoved out of their villages, is also that much worse because the country itself has been so unstable for so long.
Well, there's partly the instability, but the connection that I see is this. As Augustine said, in connection with the North-South conflict, it was very well documented that the government tolerated slavery. And it used in the South, as it's using in the West, allied militias, and it would allow those militias to abduct usually children, and those children were impressed into slavery. And what it reflected was the view that the government of Sudan had of the humanity of certain segments of its population. It reflected a sense of racism, that the people who were identified as Africans, as blacks, were inferior to the point where they could be enslaved. And some of that same attitude is carried over in Darfur, where again you have this perceived racial divide, and the groups that are perceived as Africans are perceived as being inferior, and that underlies the systematic attack on the civilian population.
And one of the hardest things that I find to understand in a situation like this, and Kenny Gluck, I'm going to ask you to help me with this because MSF is rarely afraid to speak truth to power. We all heard Colin Powell's review of his meeting with the Sudanese officials saying, oh, no, we made good progress. We're bringing them to the peace table when it comes to, you know, bringing an end to the civil war. And so, you know, we're hoping that they will cooperate with us in allowing the aid in. At what point do you just, you know, give up on the kind of diplomatic niceties to say, you know, it doesn't really matter what the government is saying, they're allowing too many people to die, or they're actively participating in that killing?
No, we're certainly long past that point, and we've been saying that regardless of the rhetoric of ceasefires and so on, people continue to be brutalized, and that's not acceptable. And I think the levels of death and destruction that have been brought into Darfur have demanded for a long time some international response about that it's unacceptable for these kind of actions to be tolerated. I don't know how the international community has to do that, but the time for action is long past. And I certainly agree with Jerry Fowler, is I don't care how this is going to be classified in the future, whether it's crimes against humanity, genocide, or something else. It needs action now. And the lawyers can figure out the determination of what it was later.
To Baton Rouge, Louisiana next. Clarence is joining us from there. Clarence, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a few points I would like for someone to discuss and try to clear up for me. All of my life, I've been reading about the great Sudanese warriors. I never thought of them black or white. I just thought of them as brave, great warriors. That aspect I want someone to comment on, and how now they're dividing them black or white and making them something else. Secondly, we know that Fox guards the hen house. All of these refugee camps are guarded by people of influence. These people with jobs guard protecting them are really enslaving them. So if the powers that be really want to do something, they can go in there and adjust this grievance.
Well, you see, I think that's right at the very heart of this, Kenny Gluck. I don't know whether or not it is that easy to go in and say, okay, you're supposed to be guarding the well, but in fact you're preventing people from getting the water, unless you do it with some kind of international force.
Well, I don't believe that the international community is without levers. The Sudanese government has demonstrated that when it wants people to be helped, they get helped. MSF did a very large meningitis vaccination and treatment campaign in these same areas in 1999, and there we were able to bring in everything very quickly without obstruction. In this time, we're seeing a lot of obstruction. I think there are lots of questions about holding people to account, not only for their promises, but to the spirit of international humanitarian law. The kind of atrocities that we're seeing, the kind of levels of mortality demand an attempt to hold people accountable for it. I think that's something that governments which say we're signatories to basic humanitarian law conventions like the Geneva Conventions have to ask themselves, what does this mean in terms of their responsibilities?
Let's go back to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Slater's joining us there on the line from there. Slater, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've been working on the Sudanese issue for the past 7 years. And
from what perspective, Slater? Are you in an NGO or what?
No, actually, I just went there to record their music. The songs that they sing describe the situation that they've been in. And because there was no media coverage of their situation, that was what I was trying to do to help get coverage.
And you're listening to us this morning. What are we missing here, Slater?
Well, part of the thing is, you know, we look at the situation in Western Darfur as genocide and the rest of it as civil war. And what we're missing is that this is what's been going on for the past 48 years since they received independence. They have been fighting to preserve their own way of life from being Arabized.
So what's your point, that it's a mistake to focus in on this particular crisis?
Not a mistake to focus in on this particular crisis, but that this crisis has brought to surface the reality that it's not just a civil war, that these people in the South have been fighting to prevent themselves from being Arabized.
And so what do you think should be done that's not being done or should be talked about that's not being talked about?
I think it should be talked about that Western Darfur is something that finally brought it to our attention because they're all Muslim, and therefore it's not been characterized as a Muslim-Christian fight. And it's always been the Arabs trying to Arabize the blacks in the Nuba Mountains, in the South. It's the same basic thing.
I wonder if I can take the point that you've made and broaden it a little bit to a longer-term understanding of where we are now and what happens next, because our time's a little short on the program here. We've talked about the effect of the rains, which are now just arriving, making it very difficult for the people to move around. But if we take that longer-term view that Slater's trying to give us, in that longer-term view, Kenny Gluck, the arrival of the rains, while all the farmers are living, you know, huddled under a tree somewhere instead of planting their crops, has some pretty frightening long-term implications for that entire area, I gather.
No, absolutely. I think we have to be looking forward to a population which is not able to feed itself for quite some time to come. They're not going to plant this season. In their previous harvest, what they were able to harvest was mostly destroyed or stolen. So you're dealing with a population that's been forced into destitution. And the international community is going to have to deal with that. And we have to hold the government of Sudan responsible both for the acts of violence, but also for allowing the aid to get to these people. In addition to that, we're dealing with a destruction of people's livelihoods, which has long-term implications. Your previous caller referring to the South, we've been working in the Nuba Mountains and in many parts of South Sudan for decades now. These wars have put people into long-term cycles of violence, which does destroy a community. It destroys a community's ability to survive, and that has extremely worrying long-term consequences. The populations in Darfur will need assistance in getting back to a life which is theirs, which has some sense of dignity, which has some sense of freedom, and some sense of sustainability, and that's going to happen, but it can only start to happen once the violence against them stops. And we're in a terrible phase now where in which thousands, tens of thousands or more are going to die, and that has to be our first priority. But it's very important to be keeping our eye on these people's right to go back to their homes, their right to go back to their villages, their right to recreate their lives.
You said often in
these emergencies, people forget about that second.
You said tens of thousands of people are going to die. Is that a given at this point, even if the measure of aid and assistance were ratcheted up?
Well, it's very hard to predict mortality when we in our studies, which look at past mortality, in some we looked at displaced people from over 100 villages. 5% of these people had already died, and this is just in the period from November until February. 5% of the population in over 100 villages had died. People were dying in the camps we surveyed at the rate of 5 per 10,000 per day. We're scared that it's only going to get worse.
Jerry Fowler, one of the reasons why you went to Chad is that you also wanted to just see that piece of the country, given that we've heard and read it is as harsh as it is. Can you just leave us with a picture of what you saw there?
Well, I saw a harsh desert. I saw vast expanses where there's not a whole lot of vegetation. And I saw a place where if you don't have food and you don't have water and you're prevented from getting food and water from outside help, that you are going to die. And I think those are the conditions that are being inflicted on people in Darfur. They've been separated from their food. They've been separated from the water. And international access is being impeded. And as Kenny says, they are dying now, and they're going to die in great numbers unless that access is allowed.
Jerry, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
No, you're very welcome, Dick.
Jerry Fowler, Staff Director of the Committee on Conscience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Kenny Gluck, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Kenny Gluck is Operational Director for Doctors Without Borders, joining us there in a studio from Amsterdam. Earlier in the program, we talked with Samantha Power in Chad. She is the author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, and a human rights activist. For more information about what's happening in Sudan and for photos of the refugee camps in the Chad area, you can go to our website, www.theconnection.org, and follow the links that are there. Our program is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts, with help today from Mike Toda. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.